Mr. Larry Gaines, Reel 3. You were just telling me about your friend who had the corn.
Yeah, well, he had this corn just at the top of his tail, and we sat down there, and he was always in pain. I always used to hear him moaning about this corn on the boat. And heard this chap come along shouting, "Now cut corn, Waller." So he came up. I said to him, I said, "Can you get corns out?" And he just came over and sat down on his haunches. He said, "Yes, sir," he said, "I get corns out. Boutique, I said." We didn't know what he was talking about.
What does it mean?
Very good, you know, boutique. Very good now cut corn by that. I said, we were none the wiser, so. He took his boot off and his sock. And I said, "Now cut comb." I looked, "Oh, Bella Wallace Abbey," he says. "Boutique eyes."
What does it mean?
Well, big corn, you know, very big corn, very nice. At any rate, we sat there and he fiddled around in a bag and he came out with a similar thing to a cigarette holder. You know what cigarette holder is. And he put this over the top of this corn and then he sucked on it on the end and left it, stood up there after he's drawn, you know, the air, and he just said, "Oh, that is okay, Sap," he said. "Just 5 minutes," he said. "5 minutes, you have no corn." At any rate, we didn't attach any importance to it. So a blooming thing had come off, it'd still be there, you know. So, and he sat there with his thing. He said, "What's happening?" He said, "God," he said, "a pain." He said, "Like somebody pulling me toe off, you know." I said, "Well, what's the matter?" He said, "Jesus God." I said, "Well, don't touch it, because..." No. Chap said, "No, do not touch that." He said, "It is coming out." And my mate said, he said, "But don't come out." He said, "You will." He said, "I'm telling you." The old cut Cornwall, he laughed. And he just lifted it up. And sure enough, there was this root, this corn, in the end of this thing, in this little hole. And don't know how he's done it, but I've tried. And during the time in India, we had some little thing wrong. We stuck a small hollow pipe or something and tried to suck it, but it didn't work. We couldn't make it work. Yet these wallers, they could do it.
So it was like a tube that you put.
It's a kind of a end of a cigarette holder, you know, goes up to a hole and place that over there, and they just suck the air up and it draws it and just leave it there, and that's drawing it all the time. But we couldn't seem to do it with different gadgets, and we don't know whether it was the type of holder that he had, you know. So I thought, well, this is interesting. This is our first day in India and here we are cutting corns out.
What was your first impression of India, of Karachi, when you first landed?
Well, because naturally we were bewildered. I mean, we got off the boat and we'd heard so much about India and whatnot. And when we got off at Karachi at the time then, I should say it was coming up 120 in the shade. We used to think that was funny when we heard about this 120. Wow, ridiculous, you burn up. But sure enough, it was so hot, we just sat down there. And as I say, there was all this different trade talk, you know, with the natives shouting, taxi wallers. These chaps tearing about, and they did tear about too, not like air taxis, you know. And we could see these cars driving all over the road, and we say to a fella, "So all these cars going about, all their taxis, they go mad when a boat comes in." course, we didn't know. It's something that we learnt, you know. They tear into a boat, pick up passengers to various hotels in Karachi. But we didn't have a hotel in Karachi. We were waiting for a train.
Can you remember that first train journey?
Yes, oh yes, that was very interesting. We got on there, and because the trains out there, you know, you had your... I mean, there was no soft padded seats. They had the old wooden benches and the bunk up the top. And you sit on there and all night, and we found, discovered, that we even had a charwalla on the train. Because we didn't realise it, but not till later, that the charwalla belonged to the contractor of the regiment, you know, the Indian side, Shamsuddin. He was a contractor for the Dorset regiment, see? And I suppose what happens when he knows he's got a draft coming over, his charwallas, the various, were sent to meet the boat. And then they came back with us on the train. And I always remember these because one particular charwalla, he had a deformed hand, you know, and he was Air Charwalla Headquarter Company. And I knew him for the 7.5 years I was out there. We used to call him Gammy, because he had this Gammy hand. And very likeable chap. Nice fella. And intelligent. There's nothing you wanted to talk around. Gammy would know the answers. He could tell you things, you know, tell you stories about life in India and all this, but... And he even used to class himself as a fortune teller. Because he told me, I was getting near my time, he told me that I would die in India. And I said to him, well, this is one time, Gammy. I said, you're wrong. I said, good, I'm going home next week. Okay, Sab. Okay, you go home. He said, but I say, sir, you die in India. I said, no. And that's when I got the wind up. My boy went out. You know, it's one of them things you... Well, I don't know. Is it meant to be? Would it be him instead of me? Because it was my name, you know. And of course, he got back okay, so that put Gammy's fortune out. So my boy said, oh, I shouldn't shout, Dad. He said, oh, John, you're alive. He said, he's got a chance, hasn't he? He said, you keep on, you'd like to go back to India. He said, if you win the football pools, you go back to India. He said, then you've got to watch it. So I said, no.
So in general, you didn't find that the Indian fortune tellers were very good then?
Well, I didn't believe in it. It's a thing I don't believe in. I mean, if they could tell your fortune, well...
Were fortune tellers very common in India?
Well, when I say fortune tellers, you... they were always on the make, I think. You know, bakshis. They say they could tell your fortune or the stars or something. Well, we could do that. We sit on the brand and find out the stars and point it all out, but... I think what happened, when you first go out there, they play on your mind. I mean, you've come from a foreign country to them. This is the East. Everything's strange. They must have read books about it, you know. They're all keyed up. And we get out there, and they try to capture us in the atmosphere, you know. Oh, we tell your fortunes, everything. Because at times we used to think, I wonder, but in the end, no, we wouldn't have any, because they were on the make all the time. The only time I think we used to feel mean was Salcott. You asked me earlier on, did we get up to any pranks? Well, as I say now, going back 40 years or more, it's beginning to come out. Little things that I've never even given a thought, such as church prayed on a Sunday in Selcott. You're getting ready, the boot boy, each particular department had a boot boy, two boot boys who cleaned the silver, the drums, and your boots, and done all that. They cleaned up, and when we come back, all the wallahs used to be outside the bungalow. That'd be the char wallah, Nelcut corn wallah, there's several, there's about half a dozen different types of tradesmen, where you used to have something on the book, the Dobie wallah. And if you were short of cash, you'd get you cigarettes on the katap, on the book. So come Friday, you owed half of your money out to these wallahs. So we used to, they'd be outside there, and they're suddenly shouting. Every time they spotted somebody, "Ah, Gainsad, you owe me 15 rupees, you know." I'd say, "Achar, Gammy, see you in a minute."
What was his name?
Gammy, because he had this gammy hand, you see. So you go inside, and really, it wasn't funny. But at the time, you didn't think of it that way, you know. So we go in, say, "Right, okay, he wants 15 rupees." So you get your 15 rupees, and I get me drum, and I put this 15 rupees on the drum. See? And I take the drum out. I say, "Yeah, Gammy, it's your 15 rupees." He say, "Achar, no good, sap, no good, you no good, game, sap." And he'd create and shout, and he'd run back. I said, "I've offered it to you, you've refused it." Fair enough. Put the 15 rupees back in my pocket.
Why wouldn't he take it from the drum?
The skin was pork, pig skin, you see, and that was against their, because not now, I mean, they're all plastic, modern equipment drums and that, but them days, the skin head of a drum was pig skin, you see, and they knew it. I mean, if you come down the road, marching from church or somewhere like that, you'd see them race across the road away from you, you know, if you come on them unexpected with your drums, tear away and stand, about 50 yards away from you because you've got these skinheads. And as I say, it wasn't funny, but to us, as usual, acting a fool, we used to, and they'd report us to the Sergeant Major, you know, we'd have to pay up in the end. But it was a mean trick to play.
You were telling me about the journey on the train, about the wooden seats and the charwalla coming round.
Yeah, well, the charwallas used to come up, and as I say, that's when we first got to know Gandhi. Well, that's what I mean. You see, you jump about. You can't help it. Because over 40 years, you've got to, you'd be good to remember A to B. And as I say, this charwalla come up, and used to sit there, used to stand there talking, and as the train was going by, I'd say, "Well, look at that." And Gammy became quite an interpreter to us. You say, "Oh, actually," he didn't know our names then, you know. "Oh, sad, that's so and so sad. This is Sin Desert, sad. Miles and miles, you know." And we didn't know what it was. It was all, he kept saying, "Well, when are we coming to civilization, you know?" "Oh, plenty of time yet, sir." And he'd look at his watch, and, "Oh, another 2 hours." I said, "What are this?" So he said, "All right, I'll have a kip. I'll wake you up," he says. "I'll wake you up with a cup of cha." And to us, somebody making a fuss, which you never had before in the army, you know, at home. But he was a kind of a servant, you know what I mean? You didn't have to call him, he was there. He seemed to be there every time you wanted him. And he he'd help you in any way, no matter what it was, or if you was going somewhere, he'd warn you, you know, or don't go bazaar, going somewhere, no good bazaar, you know, he'd warn you straight away, or don't go down any particular part of the bazaar. So he became more or less our kind of bodyguard in one way, you know, tell us what not. But then again, as I say, poor old Gammy, he went through a hell of a lot with us, but he took it all in good part. And when we went up the hills at night, it was getting dark, and he'd come along with his tea can on top of his head, Oregon lamp in his hand, you know, and the other hand up here, singing away, frightening the spirits away. And we sat there one early evening, it was, at the bungalow, and we wanted to do something, you know, what can we do tonight? And all of a sudden we spotted this big melon. Like a football. And I said, I know. And we had a rope, tug of war rope, and we got this out quick. Set this melon on the end of this rope, and there's a narrow track goes down to the countryside. And we tied the rope to the tree to make it look real, you know. And then and we stuck these two big phosphorus things that look like eyes in this melon's head, pointing it to the way poor old Gammy was coming. And he was coming along with his chair, singing his head off and waving his hands. And just before he got to us, one of the lads pulled this rope. And because what happened? The ruddy melon fell off the end of the rope, didn't it? And rolled. Gammy dropped his chair, he dropped the can. And you could see him tearing down the countryside with his hurricane lamp, swinging around, chanting, "Hello, hello." So, of course, when he dropped it, there was all his cigarettes and everything he had in the box, you know. And we whipped up these cigarettes and dashed in, put them under our pillow. We laid there, and it was quite some time. In the end, you could hear Gammy outside, contractor, the manager, you know, up there, provost sergeant, coming along the bungalows. And they switched the lights on. He didn't know what he was talking about, you know. Because he didn't see anybody, he didn't hear anybody. It was only this rope and this melon thing, and that was all gone. And the provost sergeant created, told him he's wasting his time, you know. And all of a sudden he spotted a packet of these cigarettes on the floor under the chap's bed. And stuck them all under the pillow quick, one had fell out. Provost answer, well, a packet of cigarettes, that don't mean anything. But Gammy took a chance, I said, being a child waller, he pulled his pillow from this bed. And about a couple of dozen packets of fags fell out, because we didn't have money for that amount of cigarettes. And we were all on a charge. But so happened we had a lecture, that was all, and got to cut out these pranks, you know. We were told there's such thing, there's pranks and pranks. That could have been the death of the Jawala or something. And we said, well, not the speed he was going down the countryside. And the trouble was, it was poor old Gammy, the Jawala, who stuck by us, you know, through thick and thin. Money they used to waste on football betting. The Jawalas, the now cut Cornwallers. If A Company come out and they were playing the drums, the drummers, boot boys and charwaller, they'd be there throwing money that the drummers were going to win, you know. And A Company charwallers, they were betting the same. Well, they used to end up in free fights amongst them.
Did you ever see any fights?
Only, well, when you say fights with them, they just go out and crash one another with something in their hand and chase one another across the mire, damn, that was it. But no serious fights.
Didn't you say that the barrack servants had very good memories and could tell you exactly what the hill stations were going to be like that you were going to. You said that they'd prepare you for what it would be like in the hill stations before you went, and that they had very good memories.
You're referring to the Wallers?
Yeah.
The Chowallers and all... Yes, well, because they'd been there before, hadn't they? I mean, people before you, I mean, they'd been up with them. But I don't know contractors, but I think these particular Wallers we had, I don't know, I think they're with the regiment all the way. Every regiment has got its own contractor. Shams ad-Din was their contractor. But... I think they knew. We used to say, "Well, we're going up to Rannicket. What's Rannicket? Where is it?" And they'd explain it to you. You know, so and so. Well, I should be at Rannicket. We should be at Rannicket. I'll show you when we get to Rannicket. As I say, from the beginning of your service in India to the end, you were never without a guide. There was somebody there in front the whole time. You wanted to ask questions, he was there. And it was so, the country itself was so peaceful. Like to England, I mean, you get main roads, traffic. But once you got to India, you seemed to shut the slide doors behind you, shut all that out. And there was all this atmosphere, lovely warm sun and peace. Even, I think, on the plains we didn't have any, what you call, noise. Lahore was about the nearest to tarmac roads and big restaurants I'd seen when we were out on a fortnight's holiday. But I think India itself, in general, is a very peaceful place. You can't imagine the trouble that, you know, before my time out there, like Indian Mutiny and all that. You can't imagine all that. I've read the book on it. And, of course, I say you can't imagine, but sizing them up on the spot, being there, you visualise that book and you try to visualise them taking part in these various things, especially Meerut. I mean, Meerut played a big part in the Indian Mutiny. You see, they had the church, where we used to go to church from Meerut. To the story of Meerut, they went to church with no rifles, left them in the barracks. So they had no arms to, you know. But we took rifles, or the companies, band and drums didn't. The companies took rifles to church. But apart from that, I mean, apart from that, it was, you take my mind off my track, isn't it marvellous?
You were going to say about how quiet it was there and peaceful. But you were telling me earlier that you had two instances in which you were brought out as troops because of political disturbances.
Oh, yes. Well, that was... I'd only been out there, fortnight? I was a raw recruit in India. And I always remember it was on a Thursday afternoon, under the charpoy, under the mosquito net on the charpoy, and we heard this commotion. And as I say, being recruits, we thought it was one of those things that happens out there, until some of the older soldiers, so-called old sweats, were saying everybody outside, and we couldn't understand it, but we went outside and bring your rifles. They went outside with their rifles and bayonet. And when I got out there, all I could see, to me, the impression I got was thousands of little white hats. Well, which turned out to be Gandhi hats, they called them. Gandhi's followers always wore these white hats. I said, and we were told to form up, form line, and turn these people about. As they were out of bounds, they weren't allowed in the cantonment, the barrack area. I said, and we just had to march them back. They just turned about, went on their way, we got them onto the main road. We had no trouble at all. Gandhi was in front, apparently. The famous Gandhi, now, I realise, he just led them on. And to me, he must have some control, one little man with all those hundreds of followers. He just says the word and they followed him. They went out. And that's the last we saw of them.
So which cantonment was this that they'd invaded?
Meerut. Some people say Meerut, but I've always said Meerut. It's the way we pronounce it.
What impression did you get of Gandhi? Can you remember
it? Well, actually, you didn't see him that long. From where I could see, he was really, to me, he seemed to be a funny little man. He was so small and his big glasses in amongst all these, there must have been 300 to 400 of these followers, you know, coming through the cantonment. And when he saw what was happening, he seemed to be swallowed up amongst all these hats and working his way back through, and they just turned and followed him. And that was the last we saw him. There was no trouble at all.
Was the crowd excited?
No, it was just this buzz, you know, how they mumbled between them. Of course, when I look back now, I suppose it was some political, you know, it's their country, we're allowed through here kind of business. But as I say, being young then, I was only 20, just got out there, we didn't attach any importance to it. It's one of them things we learn as time goes on.
Wasn't there another case where you had to turn out against political